This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum. I'd like to welcome you to our conference call here, recording. And we have a few presenters today talking about leveraging community solar for low-income and rural areas. So we're going to start out with John Walter with Repower YOLO. John, why don't you start out talking a little bit about what's going on in that area?
That's great. So we're – thank you very much, and I appreciate you pulling this together. So I'm a solar developer, been involved in both low-income and some rural developments of solar in our county, which is YOLO County, and in some other areas. I'll first make a couple comments on low-income. In the low-income arena, of course, it's a lot about financing, finding creative ways to finance and then distribute the benefits to both the financiers, of course, but also to the tenants. And one important point to raise here is that in many low-income areas, reducing their electricity costs by a mere $30 a month is vital. It means they can eat or they can, pay for gasoline for that month. They're very sensitive to very low levels of improvement. And a lot of times, solar builders and installers don't even pay attention to such low electricity bills. So the key is, the first key, of course, is financing, and lease products are coming out. Creative leases tend to be the way that they're going in our area. The second way is to figure out, as I already mentioned, the ways to distribute the benefits to the tenants. And, of course, everybody knows that trade-off is tough, and particularly tough because if you just wrap their costs into their rent, then how do you identify and then control or motivate those to keep their energy usage at a modest level? And then finally is making monitoring easy for the organization that or whoever's providing the service so they don't have long periods of time where the system is down and nobody knows about it. So on the rural side, of course, you have a whole mix in the rural community. If it's ranchers and farmers, it's almost always about, two big uses. One is co-ops, and most of them in our area have already gone solar because it makes such great sense. They have very high usage for a very short period of time. So that equation works great. But if it's a lot of smaller farmers and ranchers have, rely on wells or pumping in our area, and in some cases, it's about providing power where running a power line would be very expensive or running a very long irrigation line or canal would be expensive and, of course, lead to water evaporation, et cetera. So they're looking at to deliver hookup directly solar to a pump, a DC pump, so they don't have they don't have the cost of bringing power to a particular point. Those are the points I was going to make, and I'll pass it on to Michael.
Michael, I'll introduce Michael. Michael Walton is from Green Spaces Chattanooga in Tennessee. And, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, so our organization is a sustainability nonprofit, and our experience with solar has really been more on the sort of project development side. We haven't built anything yet in terms of community solar. We're in the process of building a series of zero energy homes. But what we have been doing is we were part of a Department of Energy accelerator for clean energy and energy efficiency in low-income neighborhoods. And it's really been through that process that we've explored a pretty wide range of different types of solutions to specifically community solar in low-income neighborhoods. We haven't focused as much on rural. But what we found in that process is that, unsurprisingly, it depends heavily on the involvement of your sort of utility landscape. And so in parts of the country where that's where there's plenty of opportunity to install a community solar array and sell it at competitive rates through community choice aggregation and SREX and other things like that. I think it's a really great tool, and it's a no-brainer. There's some really great organizations that have been doing a lot of it. Grid Alternatives is one of my favorites, and Groundswell in D.C. is another. In the Tennessee Valley Authority footprint, however, we're not quite so lucky. So all of the generation in TVA's footprint basically has to be owned by TVA. And their system-wide capacity that they've provided for community solar is only 10 megawatts, which is a joke. I mean, they don't even, their operators don't talk in units less than 100 megawatts. And so 10 megawatts of community solar, they don't even see that. It's invisible. And so that's forced us to sort of look at other ways of going about it. And so another option that we're in the process of working on right now, actually, is going to a very high industrial user and looking at putting community solar behind their meter such that it never produces enough that it would have to be sold back to the grid. So it's basically just pure offset energy that industrial user doesn't have to pay for. And then they, in turn, would basically donate the savings toward the initiative. And in this case, the initiative is focusing first on energy efficiency in the low-income neighborhood and creating products around that and creating training programs around that. And then eventually having that move into sort of direct assistance. I will say another thing that we explored before we got shut down by TVA that I think has a lot of potential are state LIHEAP programs. There's only a couple that have done this so far, but it's conceivable that the state can use the low-income home energy assistance program dollars that they get from the federal government to install community solar projects. And then instead of that money then just going directly to helping somebody pay a bill one time and that's it, you know, it becomes an investment, and then that money gets stretched further in the future. So that's another thing that I think is a really great thing worth exploring for those of you that haven't heard of that. And I'll pass it on to the next person.
I can see each of these topics require an hour all by themselves. So, Roger Wilkins is Great Athens County. I don't know if that's what you're still going by, Rogers, but that's one of your organizations. And he's from Ohio and also doing very interesting things over there. So, Roger, go ahead.
Okay. I'm in rural southeast Ohio, sort of the northern tier of Appalachia. We have a lot of small rural people who don't get very good opportunities for installing solar. Often their roofs face the wrong direction, or they're shaded, or they're renting the property, or the roof's in disrepair. And so community solar is a great option for low and moderate income families in our area. And through the nonprofit that I'm representing here, which is called Upgrade Ohio, we're rolling out a multi-phase project of community solar, and we're implementing the first phase of that in the next couple of months. We're going to be installing solar on a rural high school, on a public housing building, and a community resource center, and we're funding those partially by a new local investment group that we're pulling together of impact investors, and also by subscriptions that we can sell to folks who are not qualified investors. And those are really the vehicle for addressing low and moderate income families. And in the second phase, we hope to add a low interest loan fund that will allow low and moderate income families to purchase subscriptions with a very small amount of money down and then pay off their loan partially with the payments they're receiving as proceeds from the community solar. They'll also get a small cash benefit, so they're seeing that in their pockets while they're paying down their share, and eventually they'll own some panels on the school or the public housing building. And for many of the poor families that we're dealing with, that may be the first thing beyond a car that they actually own. So it's a pretty significant step.
Hey, Catherine, you're getting involved in this too. This is Catherine Johnson from Johnson Consulting, and Catherine's from Maryland.
Yes, hi. So actually, this has been really terrific just in listening to everybody. I'm involved because I'm in the process of researching various community and low-income solar activities for one of the states that I work in, and I'm basically trying to get some information about, you know, some success stories and some of the challenges having to do with promoting low-income community gardens or low-income solar. Because there's a lot of concern about how does this work, and obviously how can you tie it to utility programs if you can do that, and how do you tie it to the income assistance programs and make sure that the customers don't lose their benefits. So I'm here mostly just to listen and learn. I've been learning an awful lot about some of the different innovative solar community garden projects that have been happening all over the country, including in Cook County, Chicago, and out in the Pacific Northwest, and in Minnesota, and a lot of different places. But I'm really kind of interested to see, you know, maybe what are some of the strategies. I'm really interested in what I believe it was Michael was telling us about the state LIHEAP program. I'd love to learn more about that. And also the concerns, if there's any, about when you involve utilities about cost effectiveness. So I'm mostly here to listen as opposed to participate, but I'm enthralled.
So Michael, why don't you all four of you just go ahead and ask each other questions? Michael, why don't you start out with the answer to Catherine's question? If you can.
So I think California and New York, if I remember, or maybe it's New Jersey. I know there are some states that have used their LIHEAP dollars with approval from HUD to build renewable energy, to build solar arrays. And so HUD has approved that as, you know, a legitimate use of those dollars. And so sometimes because of the state's particular qualification process, sometimes they have money left over at the end of the year that they weren't able to basically give out for the utility assistance, and so that money can be used either directly or used to leverage a bond to build a solar system that would then provide ongoing revenue to help supplement the federal dollars, which, you know, may or may not exist in years to come.
Do you know anything? I'm sorry, this is Catherine. Do you know any? Uh-huh. Do you know if this payment affects the eligibility of a LIHEAP customer, because they have to obviously have a certain income level, and if they go above that income?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the LIHEAP customers themselves. I mean, it's basically in Tennessee it would be the Tennessee Housing and Development Administration, and so in other states it would be whoever administers the LIHEAP program.
So the administrators invest in the solar, not exactly.
The administrators invest in the solar, and then the money generated by the solar goes back into the pool that can be used for direct assistance.
Got it. Thank you.
And it could be, it could also be at a local level, I should say. So, like, so usually the state gets the dollars and then distributes it to a number of smaller entities, either cities or sort of quasi-governmental groups that cover the more rural regions. So it could be those smaller entities that would essentially do the same thing. They would use the dollars either directly or to leverage a bond to build a solar array and then, again, use the proceeds of that to benefit the applicants.
I also had another question. Somebody was talking about social impact bonds. Was that? Did I hear that?
Yeah.
Was that you, Mike?
I heard that. No, it wasn't me. It was George John.
Pardon?
Roger here.
Roger talked about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not specifically a bond program. It's a local investment group that is forming of social impact investors that have been looking around the country for places to invest and decided they would much rather pool their resources locally and support our community solar project. So it's not going to be a bond per se, but rather an investment vehicle.
Just to piggyback on that, there's an organization called the Croatan Institute, C-R-O-A-T-A-N Institute in, I think it's in North Carolina. And they, I think in December or January, released a really good publication through their, they I think manage the Divest Invest program to basically get these really, really huge foundations that have large amounts of principal that gets invested to basically use their investments more in line with their philanthropic grants. And so they, I think that the report that I'm thinking of is climate-related investment for resilient communities, and it sort of outlines really the need for exactly what Roger is just describing. I mean, more investment opportunities that have both environmental and social benefit. There's growing demand for it, basically. So I think it's really cool to hear that, Roger, that's happening.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting about what's happening in certainly in South, where you are in Ohio, Roger, with the Appalachian community and the fact that, you know, they really do live in pretty awful housing. So for them to be able to get solar even as part of a garden or some sort of community investment would certainly help them out in their bills, right? Isn't that the...
Definitely. And it also is a way of opening a larger dialogue with a larger group of people about energy efficiency and insulating homes and doing a variety of things where we may be aware of programs that they aren't aware of, but once we have the beginnings of the conversation, and we think that these solar, small solar investments are a way to open that conversation, and we'll be holding meetings at local churches and community centers and county fairs and a variety of places to really gain access to the rural population and open that conversation.
Well, yeah, solar doesn't make any sense if you don't have energy efficiency. I always say you have to have your energy efficiency vegetables before you get your solar desserts, right? Isn't that how it
goes? Exactly.
No, but it's true, because otherwise solar doesn't make any sense. You have to have a well-insulated house or building or something.
Well, let me – this is John. Let me throw in a little bit of a contrarian view.
Okay.
And that is that solar is getting cheap enough, amortized over a long period of time, that you can actually make the argument that in some cases, in many cases, you really have to think about what energy efficiency work you're going to do
mm-hmm.
before actually doing it. Because many times it's easier and less expensive to add another panel than to add, or two more panels, than to peel back the walls and put insulation in, or to replace windows. I mean, the easy stuff is absolutely, but throwing everything under the home energy efficiency umbrella leads us down a path that is really not that economic anymore, despite what history has shown. And part of it is that it's really expensive to do. It's really hard to understand what the benefits are individually. I mean, globally, absolutely. Individually, that's really tough. And where do you start? Low-income housing, especially if it's single housing or rural housing, I mean, really what you got to do is knock down whatever dwelling they have and rebuild it. But that's not scalable. So.
Well, I would say that, I would agree with that to a certain extent, but where we start is really even below the efficiency with education. So, you know, having the homeowners understand how energy works in their home, how they use energy, how they lose energy, and what they can do to control that. Because we have users that have $300, $400, $500 a month electric bills. We get people that are like heating their house with their oven. And so from that perspective, I mean, it's free. I mean, the ROI is instantaneous if you dispel a myth that somebody should run their air conditioner at full blast all day, because it saves energy.
right.
So,
right.
You know, that's sort of the lowest of low hanging fruit. But then, I mean, I would tend to think that, I mean, certain investments we can quantify pretty easily and can get ROIs of less than 3 years. Now, if solar gets to an ROI of less than 3 years, then yeah, I could see how your argument would make sense. But if that, I mean, right now, at least in our market, we're looking at like 10 years for a residential array, and we're looking at, you know, 15 to 20 for a commercial array like community solar.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also doesn't make a lot of sense to install solar in a house that, you know, has some other problems with it too. I mean, one of the whole points of the whole low income programs have been to make improve health, comfort, and safety, and I think solar can certainly add on to that, but we need to make sure that it's a safe place to be. And I've been to Hawaii where they, you know, have a very aggressive they had for a while a very aggressive solar water heating program targeting, you know, middle income people, and the houses in Hawaii are interesting, to say the least, architecturally, but, you know, solar water heating made sense because it's what they use, but they didn't use it for their home heating because their houses were not in really great shape from a structure point of view. They could do solar water heating better than they could do solar PV, is what I'm saying. But because the shape of the house and the state of the house was sometimes questionable. So I think you need to have both. I understand, you know, the problem is if it gets so cheap that solar is so cheap, but then we still, I mean, what's the point of putting a solar unit in a house that doesn't have a good, you know, building envelope even, you know, then you're going to have to use as much more electricity to generate heating or to run things than you would if it was well insulated. That's my only
concern. Okay, let's get away from the debate about, solar versus energy efficiency, which I think is important, but get back to the how to solve a problem areas. And I'd like to open it up, unless you have some other questions specifically for each other, I'd like to open it up to the rest of the people on the group here so they can ask questions as well. So hang on one second.
Well, this is Roger. I would like to make one comment. One thing that we're particularly doing is seeking situations where we can install the solar on public buildings rather than on houses that may be of varying quality. And we're bringing it in behind the meter. And so the economics of it are greatly improved by bringing it in behind the meter, just as I think the Chattanooga example with industrial sites. And for many of these people, it doesn't make sense to think about solar on their houses, but solar on community buildings that they can own a share in is a whole different proposition.
Yep.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to unmute everybody, and you can feel free to ask questions here. We don't have too many extra people in. So does anybody have a question? And I have one question for everybody before we get started. Evan, is that you on the line? Are you here, Evan? No? Okay. I have a 917 number that I don't know who it belongs to. Can somebody identify themselves from 917?
Hi, it's
that was Janine. Diane Mahon from Johnson Consulting.
Oh, Diane. Okay, and then somebody else is also 917?
Ron Kamen from EarthCound Energy.
Oh, Ron, okay. I have you in twice here. And then there's a 408 number as well. Who's at 408?
Wendy Boyle with the Clean Coalition.
Wendy?
Boyle, B as in boy, O-Y-L-E, with the Clean Coalition.
Oh, okay. Super. I just didn't recognize your number there. All right, very good. So go ahead, and anybody have questions for these folks? There is, I'm sure you do.
This is Kalina Robb. I'm in Virginia and have some issues with, getting utilities to lead the charge in terms of, innovative solutions. And I was wondering if there's any experience, or have you all seen maybe third-party providers, such as competitive service providers, bringing innovative solutions into the market?
Anybody?
I can talk just briefly. In California, there's been a huge surge of interest in creating these community choice energy groups, which essentially means that the community owns or is responsible for the electricity generation. And that may mean, and the concept, of course, is once they have that, then they can use dollars generated very locally to setting up small to mid-sized community gardens that they would then sell back to their customer base. And that provides a centralized funding source, and it also allows the local communities to sort of pair the high-priority energy efficiency with some kind of solar solutions.
This is Baird Brown. I'm very familiar with what California is doing on community choice aggregation. But in some of the other states that folks have spoken from, either to my knowledge or my suspicion, the regulatory scheme is not terribly friendly to anybody selling electricity at retail if they're not the incumbent utility. And I wonder if people could comment on it's one thing for people to own something, but how are you allowing them to get the metered benefit of the power?
We have one person typing. If you wouldn't mind muting your phone, that would be great. Appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Roger.
Yes, this is Roger Wilkins. I helped start and was executive director of a community choice aggregation program here in Southeast Ohio. It's still in existence and doing very good work, but it has been thwarted several times in trying to build a partnership through which we could install a substantial solar garden and sell that power back through the grid with the cooperation of our utility. And the way the economics work out in our area, it is much more feasible for us, as I said, to do these projects where we're coming in behind the meter, because by the time we run the power through the grid and the utility attaches all of its costs and riders, it's not economic, and the partners in the community choice aggregation, the cities and counties and villages, aren't willing to sign on at that cost. And so we've tried for several years to do a project like that, and it hasn't come to pass yet. As the economics change, it may well, but it's not there yet.
I can ask a question if there's nobody else.
And who is this?
This is David Kay at the Community and Regional Institute. I'll frame it. Question very broadly first. So a lot of the issues that have just been mentioned are generic to any kind of community choice aggregation schemes, and I'm wondering if people could comment on, as they already have to some extent, on what's special about programs particularly serving low-income and rural folks. I've heard a couple comments on that, but I wonder if somebody would have anything additional to add. And I'll add a second question, which is related, which is the difference between, it seems really important to me to think about the difference between the actual behavioral changes that the low-income folks, renters, or low-income homeowners themselves need to make versus those that somebody can do for them and offer the benefits, because the incentive structures are going to be very different. And I'm saying that in the context of difficulties that already exist in getting even more well-to-do people to make these investments themselves, thinking about, you know, long-term paybacks.
This is Michael. We've actually toyed with an idea of using community solar leases specifically as an incentive to get sort of through an efficiency program. And so it's sort of like a, you know, once you like pass all these different levels, basically like you attend a workshop, you do an in-home sort of workshop, you know, invest in one of the top three things from an energy audit, then you get a share of the community solar project for a set period of time as a reward. So is that sort of what you're imagining?
That's a very creative way of doing it. So that's certainly one. I did hear you say that you're just thinking about it. Does that mean that you haven't actually done it yet, or that?
Yeah, we developed that as part of a proposal for another community solar project, and didn't get funding for it, so we didn't do it.
I guess another thought that's a little bit in the back of my mind, which comes from you know, from thinking about housing context, is the question of, given the very, very limited funds that low-income families have available to them, whether spending their limited funds on, you know, if you think of some of these community-scale aggregation programs as an investment for them, about is it the best way to spend their money or not, is a question. Whereas it may be very clear from the perspective of an agency that they should do it. It's not always as clear that it's the best way for low-income people to spend their money. So that was a little bit of...
Baird Brown, if I can interrupt and make a suggestion. I mean, most of the kinds of projects that we're talking about are ones that pay for themselves, you know, so, and maybe leave a couple of bucks left over besides. And we, you know, there are lots of programs that are sort of run as subsidies, and we heard about LIHEAP, and I'm on the board of an organization that's doing a lot of those kinds of programs, but starting to take advantage of the low-income purchasing power, because the one thing they really are spending money on are rent and utilities, and you know, reducing that and getting the results, you know, is a win-win.
Comments, anybody?
Yeah, I mean, most of the programs that I've seen in the space that are benefiting low-income families are not asking them to invest. It's a, you know, it's something that somebody else has invested in that's being provided to them. I guess another good example that's worth bringing up is Nixon Peabody in Washington, D.C. That's a huge law firm. They installed solar on the roof of the building that they're in Washington, D.C., and if I remember correctly, basically kept sort of the benefit of half of it and then donated, they have virtual net metering there with Pepco, so they were able to do virtual net metering for a specific low-income housing co-op that they basically partnered with. I think that's another really great example of a way to do this.
Jared, any comments on that?
Yeah, I think this is all leading to the, at least in my mind, the $64 million question is how you align the benefits to all the parties. So some people have talked about investment, and when I think of investment, I think of a return. Well, how do the parties, other than tax incentive, tax benefits, forget that for a minute, but other than that, how do you bridge the gap between the owner and the tenant? Does the owner take over the ownership and management of the energy? Does the, whether that's a housing complex or, a low-income housing area, or are they metering individually and then somehow distributing benefits and then somehow monitoring them? How does that – any models out there that have made sense?
This is Roger again. The model that we're implementing for low-income folks is that they will subscribe to this service at some level and in essence own – one or more of the panels on the neighborhood school, and we're doing things to encourage them to make that identification, the schools being important social centers in rural areas. And then through Arcadia Power, which is a national organization, we're setting it up so that their electric bills will be credited with whatever portion of the proceeds are coming from their subscription. So they'll be seeing their utility bill going down and see a credit on it in virtue of their participation.
Interesting. What's the amortization of their subscription? Is it sort of over 20 years, or I'm not talking about their commitment, just
right,
the amortization rate. I'm just trying to understand sort of the cost benefit.
Yeah, it's going to vary with each of the specific projects, and I don't have those figures yet, but I think we're definitely looking at less than 20 years. As I said, bringing the power in behind the meter really improves the payback on these projects we're looking at.
Very good. Any other examples out there of the tenant-landlord-owner paradigm?
Any other thoughts? Questions? Catherine, you're always good for questions.
Oh, I'm just listening here. I think this is great.
This is
Cleena again, Cleena Robb from Virginia. The I totally recognize that getting it behind the meter is kind of the holy grail. Does that simply require either like the large manufacturing company to be generous, let you put it on their land and give the benefits to somebody else, or does it require the utility to agree? I mean, that's really the stumbling block we run into is that the utilities in Virginia are not fond of net metering, and so expanding it it's just tough.
Yeah, for us, the purpose of going behind the meter is to absolutely avoid net metering. So there's never any energy going to the grid. It's all being used by the large energy consumer. And that is because we don't have net metering here. There's TVA basically opens up capacity for certain types of renewable generation, and once that capacity is full, they shut the door and no more is allowed, basically. They still have DPP, which is distributed power providers. So they do have to, if somebody installs a community solar array, they do have to take the energy under, I guess, PURPA as a qualified facility, a QF, I think is what they call it. But it's only at the avoided rate, and in TVA service territory, that's like rock bottom. I mean, you're talking about like, 2 cents or something like that. So it just doesn't, the math doesn't work.
Yes, so this is Baird. So just Baird Brown, again, in Philadelphia. Just so I understand, you're putting solar on the roof of, say, a school or a manufacturing facility. The power is actually all behind the meter of the roof that you're on, and you're really creating your own virtual metering. I won't say net metering.
It's a microgrid, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's a microgrid. Have you actually got wires to the local other, or it's a microgrid for the individual manufacturer?
Yeah, it would be an internal microgrid.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. But the relationship to the low income families or households that you're dealing with is virtual and not on the electric company's books at all.
Yeah, it's not virtual really at all. I mean, it's basically a donation from the industrial user's perspective. It's a donation to a nonprofit, and we're building the case for how those funds will be used. So we're building out that budget.
Yeah. Okay. I got it.
Yeah. In our case in Ohio, we see this as a substitute for virtual net metering, which we don't have in Ohio, and we're looking to accomplish the same aims that we would if we had a good virtual net metering regulatory scheme, which we don't. The other thing I should mention, though, is that our state and many states are going through grid modernization processes right now. And we've been talking to our Public Utilities Commission about the necessity to revise the regulatory structure so that it is more open to distributed generation and feeding that in under a variety of circumstances, not just base level net metering, you know, at the lowest price they can get by with, but actually valuing the power according to how it's used to serve ancillary functions, and which is sometimes quite valuable to the regional transmission organization or to the utility. So these processes, as many of you know, are going on in probably at least a third of the states right now. It's a very significant time.
Yeah, this is Baird Brown. One of my hats is to be the counsel to something called the Microgrid Resources Coalition. You can look up the website and see the filings that we have made in state public utility commission proceedings and with FERC on a number of exactly those issues. And I think, you know, expanding the rights of customers in the situation is something that it's a perspective that needs to be brought to those proceedings.
A couple of people we haven't heard from yet, and I don't know if they want to comment, is Michelle Halsell. Is that you?
I am here, and I am listening. And Baird Brown, I just sent you an email on a different topic, but it is related to renewable energy. So please check your email.
Okay.
Okay. And Wendy, do you have any comments? Or she just disappeared, I think. So I guess not. Okay. Go ahead. I just wanted to acknowledge these people are here. I think I've covered everybody. We have Michael Diane Mahoney?
She works.
Roger, welcome. Well, go ahead and tell me the right pronunciation.
Mahon.
Mahon. How do you spell that?
M-A-H-O-N. I don't know. They can talk to themselves. They work for me, so, you know. They're my note takers.
Yes, no, I understand that. Roger Wilkins, John Walter, and Corinne is also working with Catherine. Yeah. Baird Brown, David Kay is with the, spacing out David's university.
Cornell.
Cornell, of course. I did know it, David. And you're apparently not, are you on a phone right now? Because it's not showing up as a phone number.
I am on a phone, but it's probably from a it's probably a restricted number that goes out. So you
no, that's not, okay. Couldn't figure out who that was. Ron Kamen is also with us right now. Michelle Halsell from Pennsylvania State University. Cleaner Robb is an attorney, another attorney also. So, okay, that's pretty much the roster right now. And Stephen Schwartz was with us for a while, and Wendy Boyle from Clean Coalition. So go ahead and continue.
Everybody's got questions if no one else does.
What's that?
I just say I always have questions if nobody else does, but I've already asked.
No, please. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I was wondering if people would be willing to comment a little more on, I was intrigued by the myths that are out there about what saves energy on the front lines, and I'm wondering if there are any other ones that are very common that people have run into besides the one that was mentioned about running their air conditioners all the time. And if you think there are any of them specific to low-income communities that don't also exist in other communities.
I don't know if it's myth so much as just misconceptions. People really, you know, to Michael's point earlier, low-income customers really, well, I wish it wasn't just low-income customers. All customers really, unless you play in the space, don't really think about energy efficiency at all, nor because it's such a small part of your overall budget in general, and you get your bill and you pay it, and you don't really, you know, it's not something that you think about unless it's really high and you're concerned, and then you find out there's a leaking water heater or furnace is broken or you have a hole in your roof or something. So unfortunately, energy has never really been top of mind, which is one of the big challenges energy efficiency people have faced for so long. So one of the strategies is trying to figure out what messages resonate best. And it seems to be if you can get people to think about health, comfort, and safety, which also can, you know, help you with solar too or any other kind of technology if you're going to improve your health, comfort, and safety, that actually resonates more than saving money in a lot of cases, especially for folks that don't really think about energy.
Anybody else?
Yeah, well, this is Baird. I'll just comment, though, that one of the frustrating things from my point of view as a consumer is that the folks who do home energy retrofits, and they're a very mixed bag, tend to come in and tell you about health, comfort, and safety and don't make any promises about whether they'll actually save you any energy. And they don't have contracts that are anything like what I'm used to using in, you know, more institutional or larger user settings. So, I mean, I think there's sort of, I guess I'd look for both and.
Well, I think that that's absolutely correct. We used to, they don't have the ESCO model where you pay performance, you know, pay for guaranteed energy savings. And part of that is what often happens is if you replace a furnace or a water heater that hadn't been working properly, especially in a low-income program, low-income home, then what you have is called the snapback effect, or the fact that the energy now, they were miserable before, but now that they have a well-insulated home, they can actually afford to run the furnace or the water heater more than they maybe did when it was broken. So that's one problem. So they can't really guarantee that the usage won't increase. Secondly, residential customers have a lot of other. There's a lot of, somebody mentioned behavior earlier. Behavior, people can, you know, especially in low-income communities, my heavens, they're very transient. They can have different kinds of people living in their houses at different times. Everybody and their brother has at least 5 or 6 plug load appliances, so it's really hard to say, are you going to, once we install all these measures in your house, are you going to use electricity exactly the same way you've always done, and you can promise me you're not going to buy a big screen TV or put on an addition to your house or some other thing that's going to significantly increase your usage. So that's one of the reasons that there's hesitancy to that.
Yeah, but I will say that there have been some really successful models that have come out recently. The pay-as-you-save program with the on-meter tariff, eTility, that Tammy Agard has been running, has shown extremely reliable data in terms of projections for low and moderate income energy savings.
Right, and that's assuming that they're not going to have any other changes, that the pay-as-you-save is based on an energy audit, and it's based on you're installing these measures and you're not doing anything else. And if you can get the customer to agree to that, that's great. But not every customer is able to, you know, or will, because it is the natural tendency to you know, I know pay-as-you-save has worked well because it has that's sort of the contract and you agreeing to it. But general customers and, you know, plug load has been growing for exponentially, it seems, for the last 20 years because we've gotten, you know, more gadgets than we've ever, you know, nobody ever thought we needed more than one television back in the 50s, and now we have multiple televisions and multiple other things that we didn't even know existed. So the problem is that there's the plethora of the Internet of Things is sort of competing with energy efficiency at the same time. So,
we haven't really seen a big effect of that, really.
Okay,
I mean, in terms of
good.
The, so the zero energy homes that we're building right now are filled with all of those things. I mean, their electric bill for the last 5 months has been a total of $220. So I really don't think it's sort of the device proliferation that's been driving that. I mean, especially LED TVs. That's a perfect example of the EPA and DOE rulemaking sort of driving a lot of the appliance loads down. A non-Energy Star refrigerator that you can go buy today at Sears is more efficient than an Energy Star refrigerator was just a few years ago.
No, I understand what you're saying, and I certainly agree with that. But clearly, if you can build a good, well insulated home like you do with the Zero Energy, you're going to have less chances for those kinds of activities to affect energy use. It's just that sometimes in certain areas, in programs that I've been evaluating, where the contractors, and this maybe is somebody was saying that they're good ones and bad ones, there are contractors out there that will sell you energy efficiency and sell you other things on top of it that will completely negate the energy efficiency you're getting. So, and I think that creates the overall customer confusion about what is energy efficiency and what is just living in my house. They don't necessarily, people still aren't really clear on some of that stuff.
Yeah, well,
that's totally true.
Baird, this is Baird again. I understand, and as you obviously appreciate, when you have an ESCO contract for a more commercial or institutional building, you have all kinds of schedules which say, here's the base load and I'm not going to change my usage and things like that. And probably those are overkill and unenforceable in some of the contexts we're talking about, but it seems to me that there is a challenge there that we could meet you'd like to see a home efficiency contractor standing behind the performance of their equipment, and that it may not be a whole building question, but there got to be ways with simpler contracts that are really better for both sides.
Yeah.
To make that happen, that's a challenge. I'd love to.
Well,
have.
And Baird, you make a great point. This is John talking. I think there's one other thing, and that is, frankly, the information that's available, particularly to low-income users, is terrible. It sucks. And there's no other place that I know of where we hum along, spend money, and don't have a bill for a month and don't know how much we've used. And, there are home automation systems now that are gathering data, but they're not really appropriate. They're expensive for low income. You could even have, and it's not terrible, it's just nobody's done it. I think what we need to have is you need to equip homeowners with the ability to see that they are using more energy than was forecast or using more energy than they should be or whatever qualifications you provide, but not wait till the end of the month so they get a bill.
That exists right now in some utilities. They have prepay programs where you can get literally daily notifications of how much is left on your balance and whether you're sort of in the green or in the yellow or in the red. And there's pluses and minuses to that. The obvious benefit is what you just described, is that there's a very accurate and real-time relationship that somebody has with their energy consumption. The downside is that the system isn't perfect. And so you get people that get cut off in the winter and freeze to death with cash like clipped to their bill that they were, gonna go take the next day. It's actually being rolled out right now in our local utility. And we have mixed feelings about it. As long as the right protections are in place and as long as it works, the prepay system can be really successful. It's actually used a lot in the Caribbean and in Latin America.
And in England.
Yeah, and in England. There you go.
Catherine, one comment here, and then we're going to end the call.
Okay, I was just going to say that there is one company out there, at least one, probably more, Apogee, which is an energy software provider that sells information to utilities, and they actually can let your customers subscribe to your usage, just like you get a, I get a little reminder from my phone about my data usage. They have a very similar app about your weather, your electric usage, and that is one really cool user-friendly, like you spent $4 today on your electricity that has you know, gotten some traction in certain utilities in around the country. I don't know how widespread it is, but that app is coming, and I think that's the kind of information customers need.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and end the call now, and very interesting conversation. And I'll be scheduling some more calls in the future here. So thanks, everybody, for coming, and I hope to see you next time. Thanks for the presentation.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, appreciate Sierra.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank
Bye
you.
Now.
Thanks.
Department of State.
Yeah.
Sure.
I just sent it to Jill Casey at HUD and Jill Cazzo at LCRR. I don't know why I haven't thought about that before, but
okay.
I sent a link to the website as well as the one-page flyer, so I can send you the one-page flyer if you want.
Sure, that would be good for him.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello?